truly unlike any other. His legacy will be debated, but his detractors are innumerable, intense, and international. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
President Trump authorized the declassification of documents relating to the FBI's Russia investigation, the inquiry that clouded his first years in office and that he has sought retribution for ever since. The release of the documents on the eve of his departure appears to be the final attempt by Donald Trump whilst in office to settle scores with the FBI and to undermine the investigation known as Crossfire Hurricane. Mr. Trump and his allies have long attacked the officials who opened the inquiry as politically motivated. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Adam Goldman. The piece is titled, Trump Approves Document Disclosures in Apparent Bid to Taint Russia Investigation. Stay with us for more of Adam Goldman's article. President Donald Trump has authorized the declassification of documents relating to the FBI's Russia investigation, the inquiry that clouded his first years in office and that he has sought retribution for ever since. The release of the documents on the eve of his departure appears to be the final attempt by Mr. Trump while in office to settle scores with the FBI and to undermine the investigation known as Crossfire Hurricane. Donald Trump and his allies have long attacked the officials in FBI who opened the inquiry as politically motivated. No documents were immediately released, and it was not clear what material Donald Trump declassified or why he waited until the final hours of his presidency to do so. He said there was a binder with materials on the investigation. I determined that the materials in that binder should be declassified to the maximum extent possible, Donald Trump wrote in a memo to the Attorney General and the Directors of National Intelligence and the CIA that was released by the White House. He had accepted some redactions. The White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows had also long attacked the investigation and pressed for the release of more information and documents whilst in his previous role as a congressman. While Mark Meadows served as Donald Trump's top aide, the White House repeatedly declassified documents in an apparent effort to taint Crossfire Hurricane, drawing condemnations that the administration was politicizing intelligence. Career intelligence officials objected to the move, concerned that it would jeopardize intelligence gathering and sources of information. The review by the Justice Department's Independent Inspector General determined that investigators had sufficient reason to open the Russia inquiry and found no evidence that political bias played a role in the move. Meanwhile, Meanwhile, President Trump delivered a defiant and unapologetic farewell speech to the nation in a video released on Tuesday, 19th of January, declaring that he took on the toughest battles and vowing that the movement we started is only just beginning. Donald Trump, who has not appeared in public in days and remained in seclusion at the White House in his final hours in office, sought to frame his administration as a period of progress, despite the coronavirus pandemic that has now killed 400,000 Americans and the divisions that led to the storming of the Capitol building this month by a mob of his supporters. "I did not seek the easiest course of action," Donald Trump said in the 20-minute video posted online the day before he leaves office. "By far, it was actually the most difficult. I did not seek the path that would get the least criticism. I took on the tough battles, the hardest fights, the most difficult choices, because that's what you elected me to do. Your needs were my first and last unyielding focus. This, I hope, will be our greatest legacy." Trump made no explicit concession to President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr., nor did he mention his name. After months of falsely claiming that he did not lose the election and trying to overturn the results of the election, Donald Trump has scorned the traditional transition of power, refusing to invite Joe Biden for the customary post-election visit to the White House, and opting to skip the inaugural ceremony on Wednesday, 20th of January. In his farewell speech, Donald Trump also condemned the 6th of January attack on the Capitol building without acknowledging any responsibility for encouraging his supporters to take such action, for which he has been impeached by the House and faces trial by the U.S. Senate. "All Americans were horrified by the assault on our Capitol," he said. "Political violence is an attack on everything we cherish as Americans. It can never be tolerated." Likewise, as the death toll from the coronavirus pandemic reached a macabre new benchmark, Trump offered no regrets about his handling of the virus, which he repeatedly dismissed and said would simply disappear. He claimed credit for the record-fast development of vaccines, though, which even some opponents have praised him for, but made no mention of the troubles that have slowed the distribution of the vaccines. Israel, unpunished child killers.
The men and women of Gaza are busy piecing their lives back together, attempting bravely to cope with extensive loss of life and displacement, and thousands of innocent children suffer deep trauma every day since having their families, friends, homes, hospitals, schools, etc., deliberately, intentionally bombed by Israel with its military. The story of the suffering they experienced and continue to experience is told in the looks on their faces, full of sadness and despair, especially whenever they recall the 50 days of war they witnessed and survived in 2014. At the end of that war, the number of martyrs killed on the Palestinian side reached nearly 2,500, including 500 young children. The number of the wounded amassed to 12,000, of whom 3,300 were young children. Every child of Palestine now carries with them memories of explosions, of screams of horror, of seeing dismembered and burnt bodies, of the smell of death brought down on them by the inhumane, unconscionable actions of Israel in its efforts to oppress its occupied territory. A tank massacre here, an airstrike massacre there, is all justified by Israeli politicians and condoned by Western governments that protect these Israeli war criminals from ever facing justice in court.
This is the first time I've entered the school since the incident. It's painful and depressing for me. Inside the school, I felt my brother's presence, as if he was calling my name. He was martyred here. I also got a sense that my mother wanted me to pray for him here. The feeling is of utter sadness and grief.
Hussein and Ibrahim are standing on the ruins of the house overlooking the school in the northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun. This school belongs to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. UNRWA is a UN organization. They recall back to the second day of the month of August 2014.
We are staying at the house of the late Shabab Ahmed Al-Shinbari. Here there are 25 family members all living in a three-floor house, 150 square meters. The Israeli occupation forces targeted this house during its 2014 military aggression on the population of Gaza. We were evacuated quickly and headed to the UNRWA school in Beit Hanun shortly before our house was bombarded.
It was midnight when they blew a hole in our house with a tank shell about where we are sitting. We escaped to my uncle's second house, but they dropped gas bombs there. My aunt said we should prepare ourselves to go in different directions in the morning. We went to my aunt's house in Al-Gharman Street, but the Jews entered and demanded us to leave. Finally, we went to the Western School at Beit Hanun.
We moved from our home on the first day of the ground incursion mounted by Israeli forces. We went to Beit Hanun Co-ed School A and D blocks. A municipal vehicle arrived on Thursday to transport us to another school because children at Beit Hanun had been hit by shrapnel. There was a bombardment near the school where we were sheltering.
We have informed the IDF, nearly 32 times about the school, its place, who were in that school, what they are doing, and, everything, that it is should be a safe place, that you have the UN flags and the GPS had been sent to the Israeli side. The real information, in real time, we were sending them every day about everything.
Officials at the UNRWA Relief Agency in Gaza believed Israeli army assurances regarding the guaranteed safety of their accommodation centers, accordingly informing the displaced people that a school in Beit Hanun, which was sheltering hundreds of Palestinian refugees, was a safe zone. Like blood to a vampire, however, this gathering of displaced families incited the appetite of the Israeli occupation army for killing, which found easy prey. They informed the UNRWA Relief Agency and International Red Cross to evacuate the school of the displaced. The people gathered in the school yard and waited for the arrival of buses to take them somewhere safe. All of them a clear and easy target for slaughter. The Israelis rounded them up and killed 16 of them where they stood, mostly children, and wounded more than 55 others.
The Red Cross came 2 days earlier. There were 3 Red Cross vehicles and 10 Red Crescent vehicles. They announced that they came to transport the most serious cases, such as those with disabilities, the elderly, and the injured, mostly shrapnel injuries. As they took people away, we asked them what was going on and if they thought the school was safe. They confirmed it was safe and that there was nothing to fear. We trusted that information. The UN and the Red Cross came 2 days later with buses to move more of us to the Jabalia refuge camp. People gathered in together and we all went downstairs.
My aunt was collecting laundry and about to sit and rest when the shells pounded us. Shrapnel sliced open my stomach and my intestines fell to the ground. My brother found me lying underneath my siblings. He moved me outside and on foot he took me to the Kamal Udwan Hospital. They urgently referred me to Ashifa Hospital, where I went under surgery. 10 centimeters of my intestines were cut off. Now every time I eat and when I drink water, my stomach hurts.
Five of my family were martyred, praise be to Allah. 16 other people were injured, including Manar, who lost both her legs, Ibrahim, whose intestine were reconnected, and my brother Mahmoud, who had his arteries severed.
What happened in that school, it was a real catastrophe, actually. We have tens of people that had been killed and injured in that school. The Board of Inquiry investigated, you know, what happened in Beit Hanoun school. It is a message, you know, that here in the Gaza Strip, that there is no safe place, even in a school, on the street, at your shelter, at your home, everywhere. No safe place at that time.
We don't want to stay here at the school. They forced us to come here. We don't want to be here at the school. They are all liars.
People of the world find it impossible to believe that anyone, even a Zionist occupation force, would have the audacity to bomb the accommodation centers of the United Nations. The Israeli army had orders to kill anything that moved, and this policy was exercised throughout Gaza in their ground incursion. On the 16th of July, 2014, 8 children from the Bakr family went to play on the beach of Gaza. They were kicking around a soccer ball when from Israeli military ships in the sea, missiles fired on the beach, specifically targeting the children playing.
On July 16, 2004, Ismail was sitting with his cousins. I told them that it was Ramadan and that they shouldn't be playing football and bothering the neighbors. The street is too narrow to play football. It's 2 meters wide, which is not enough room. All of us here are brothers and cousins. We live in a sector of homes the size of 1 square kilometer, which houses 1,000 people thereabouts. Ismail said he was going to play outside with his cousins. It was sunny and hot, so they went to the beach to play as they often do. It's not far, and it's the only suitable place to play, next to the part of the beach reserved for swimming.
Stay in here, son. They're shelling outside. He said he wanted to go to his uncle's house to play with their kids.
Ahid is my one and only grandson. He came after 9 granddaughters. Zakaria, my beloved son, the youngest. He was spoiled. He was my entire life. Whenever his father asked him, "Who loves you?" he always said, "He loves me."
I am accompanied by Al Said, Hamada, Yunus, Ismail, Ahid, and Muhammad, and we're heading now to the spot where we used to play as kids. We are fishermen, and so the sea is our life. We are always on the sea.
The Bak family is a renowned family. We're known to be fishermen by trade. We inherited that from our fathers and from their forefathers, who inherited it from Sheikh Bak. The sea is life and breath to us. When our children want to play, they go to the beach.
We set up the goals here and divided ourselves into 4 teams, and we played football. The boys said they're thirsty. They wanted to go drink some water and come back. I took them to get some water, and when we came back,
we resumed and finished the first round. In the middle of the second round, Ismail kicked the ball and it landed next to the container. We asked him to go get it. He brought it back, along with Mortazim, Zachariah, Ahid, and Muhammad.
The warships were there. We saw that they were filming us. They sent a missile to the beach, and it wiped out my cousin. The first missile landed there, killed my cousin Ismail, and we started running to get off the beach.
لو نزلنا من غد هم نزلوا علينا يجروا شفناهم بس شفنا سمعناهم.
The rest of the group came running toward us. We saw them, but Ismail wasn't with them. Bashir Abu Warfa was standing there. When he heard the explosion, he came out from the tent. He stood by us while we told him that Ismail was killed. The other children reached us.
They fired a second missile, and it landed here.
We decided, Hamada, Yunus and I, to hide behind the tent. Muntasir was on the ground. They fired another missile at us as we fell behind the tent. Yunus hid in a barrel while Hamada and I kept running. Muntasir ran with us. Hamada and Muntasir entered the tent seconds after us. Bashir Abu Warfa was crying out, "O people, help us. The children are dead. The children are dead."
Four of those eight kids were basically vaporized when the bombs hit. Their young bodies could not be identified or even found amongst the debris left behind. The other four dispersed in different directions, not knowing the fate of each other, as more bombs actually followed them. Ambulances and journalists came, but it was all over.
Badly wounded, I crawled until I reached help. Someone laid me on the ground and left to bring an ambulance. They wrapped my head in a bandage and laid me down. I was in a coma, so at the time, I didn't know who was killed and who was still alive.
They laid Muntasir by a wall, thinking he was dead. Hamas fainted. Yunus sat next to his brother, and I was weeping over my brother and cousins.
This other boy was with them. He came over yelling, "Mama, Mama." I said to him, "What's the matter?" He said, "Muhammad was martyred." I said, "How come Muhammad was martyred? Are you sure? You must be lying because Muhammad was here just now." He said that Muhammad was killed. I said he wasn't. But then I saw it air on TV. Children killed on the beach. The girls cried. "He was our son of 20 years. We cry over you every day, son. You are never out of our thoughts."
Each day since the day Ismail was martyred, I have gone to the beach to spot where he was killed, and I've searched for his remains, hoping the sea had washed them up. I remembered that day vividly. When I reached the hospital, I realized what I had witnessed, a massacre against humanity. Where is the humanity? Ismail's senseless murder has forever taken the smile and joy from my home.
Zakaria, Ahid, and Muntasir, who was injured but thought to be dead. Ismail and all of our kids were dead. I would not wish this on anyone. Everyone saw us on TVs and internet. What can I possibly say? I say occupation took my first grandson, who called me grandma.
The survivors of that tragic day come back to the beach, not to play as they did before, but to sit, to remember, vainly searching for a rational reason to an irrational act. It was a blatant war crime, which claimed the lives of their four relatives, with no one thus far held accountable. Meanwhile, they suffer from physical injuries themselves and the psychological trauma of it all.
Life without them is meaningless and full of despair. I'm not saying that because they are my brothers, but for the sake of all Palestinians, all of children.
I
If I was flying a jet and I saw Jewish children playing, I wouldn't target them because they are just children playing. They could see from after that we were children.
They could tell we were a bunch of kids playing. They deliberately target and kill the children of Gaza and Palestine. They want to uproot them at a young age so they won't grow up and become resistors. So they bomb them at this young age.
Incredibly, shockingly, the targeting of Palestinian children escalated and peaked on the day of Eid al-Fitr, when the children of Gaza came out to play, to lighten up, relax, and have some fun to celebrate the last day of Eid, thinking that the Israeli army would not dare to violate such a holy occasion. Israel unmercifully sent missiles down, turning their brief period of joy to incomprehensible grief.
We live in Al-Ahrar Street at the beach camp, a major street in the camp area. We awoke on the day of Eid to enjoy it like everyone else normally does. The children were playing in the street, some were playing on the swings. All of a sudden, a missile landed on top of us. It was around 3 p.m. We were surprised by the explosion, but when we turned around, we saw the children had become shreds of flesh laying in the street. Some were injured and some others were dead.
I was playing on the swings when the missile landed. I got hit with shrapnel here. Some people were killed. My uncle Shaban, Jamal, and Muhammad were among those who died. I remember we were happy and playing on the day of Eid. Who could be so wicked as to bomb us on such a holy day? The children were out playing and rejoicing. And then the missile came, and in a second they were dead. Shaban had been blown apart. Others who died were Muhammad Al-Halul, the Barid family's son, Muhammad Biqdad, and Muhammad Washah.
Muhammad Maghdad, Muhammad Washah. كان في كثير شهداء مرميين.
There were many martyrs, some scattered around on the ground, inside buildings, in trees, everywhere. The injured and the dead. Ambulances and cars swarmed on the location, and people were crying out in anguish for the loss of their children. 13 martyrs and 40 to 50 injuries. I sustained injuries to my leg here. And in my chest here. My grandfather took my cousin and I to the ambulance.
My son was playing behind the car. He was almost next to me, but he died due to bleeding caused by a shrapnel penetrating his body. When the missile first landed, I was still conscious, receiving wounds to my stomach, legs, and arms. My leg disabled and my arm was broken and behind my back. I wore a white top which was covered in blood. I looked around just before I fainted to see the extent of the brutality and carnage. The scene was horrific, their actions so brutal.
Martyrs came from several refugee families at the beach camp on the first day of Eid after being targeted by an Israeli bombing campaign. On the third day of Eid, missiles of the Israeli occupation forces targeted some little kids who were playing with their grandfather with some simple new toys they had received for Eid on the roof of their home.
A truce was declared on television on the third day of Eid. We went up on the roof with all the little children. They wanted to play because it was a time of truce. They were not allowed to go out in the street because we worried about their safety.
بعد صلاة العصر حوالي بنص ساعة ساعة إلا ربع.
After 30 to 45 minutes of afternoon prayer, we heard more explosions. There was a first, second, and third explosion. It took some minutes to work out what had happened. Our house was filled with heavy smoke, and we realized that it was actually our house that had been bombed by an Israeli airstrike.
We rushed to the roof only to see the most horrifying scene. All that remained of the elderly man and the seven children that were playing were pieces of flesh and bone. At least three had their heads blown off. I looked over the martyred children. Two of my daughters were among the victims. One had survived. She had a hole in the back of her skull. Another girl was also alive, but couldn't talk. I called her and she looked up at me, so I rushed them to the hospital.
I searched around to collect my children. First I took Abd al-Halim, then I went back inside and got Abd al-Aziz. His head had been split open. I couldn't remove my third daughter. I couldn't find her head. Then I came downstairs and stood here at the doorstep. They took away the bodies of the martyrs in ambulances. I wanted to see whether they took the body of my daughter or not. I found my niece Malik, the daughter of Jalal. I kissed her forehead and I was about to leave with the ambulance. As I was stepping out of the ambulance, a rocket from an unmanned drone hit us. My leg was hit and had to be amputated. This finger and my arm were injured too. It was a cruel airstrike. In all, there were 10 martyrs from my family, including 7 children, my parents, my brother and his daughter, and my cousin who was carrying the bodies of martyrs at the time he was hit.
After the disproportionate aggression on the population of Gaza, there are still survivors today who suffer heightened psychological effects, reflected clearly in their behavior, which is especially telling during play activities such as painting that express the evil acts that Israel perpetrated against them.
Usually after the therapy process and even after recovery, there will still be some trauma symptoms among the affected children, with most of them on edge, in high alert mode, expecting more attacks on them. That's why you find that whenever a child is playing or drawing, the played-out theme tends to represent the incident, which is causing the alerted state from their memories, from their nightmares. When we spoke to children aged around 12 who survived the last three wars, who witnessed and suffered trauma from the 2008 Israeli-imposed war and this one in 2014, after recovering from each war and after being treated, they still believed that there would be another war and another. Three wars lived through by a child. The trauma is unimaginable, and the child is left in a state of constant alertness. We can't even tell them that they are safe, that there will be no more wars, or that everything is now fine.
Whenever they unleash a war on us, we will resist and defeat them.
It is beyond any reasonable doubt that targeting children of Palestine is part of the culture and a systematic issue of the Israeli occupation army, which seeks to brand the conscious mind of all Palestinian children with the ideology that they are all the undeserved, the subhuman, that there can be no Palestinian flag, no independence, no resistance. Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding.
IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The reason why the Islamic Republic is opposed to negotiating with the U.S.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
The cure for sanctions is only and solely reliance on national capabilities. We should preserve every capability that we have in this respect, and we should be after discovering new capabilities, bearing in mind that we certainly have many capabilities. Then we should rely on and revive them. We should bring our youth to the arena and pursue the main pillars of the economy of resistance, growth from the inside, and working with the outside. We have both domestic and international capabilities. We are capable of producing inside the country in a way that various scientific, economic, and other such capabilities will start to bubble up. And we are also capable of working at an international level. We have good friends with whom we can work. This requires effort and diligence.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
The economy of resistance includes both growth from inside and working with the outside, and in both areas we have numerous resources which we can benefit from. Our capacities are really infinite. The more we move forward, the more capacities will show up. Of course, these things will be acquired with the jihadi management. They are achieved with real acumen and jihadi management. We have influential friends in the world. Of course, it is not the case that we get dependent on our friendly governments. This is not the case. Our reliance is on Allah the Exalted and on ourselves. Even if we did not have powerful friends in the world, we would do our job and we would move forward.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, riot gear, and canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
This is going to be my fighter right here. Come here.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police, and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Rich was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Lee, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism, and that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and colour pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the street just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted, yes, as saying the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that, actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they basically vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add something?
I think what it also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale of racism. And what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on and is fighting.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial
did see
inequality.
A lot of white people in the crowd in support of the black community.
No, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse. Over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop wash stick on there. Got some walkie-talkies. It's two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one to my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera, that's my weapon, you know? And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
We saw David there with the Cop Watch Initiative. He's quite an endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And, of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile?
Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. they covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that moratorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So that's there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long as it's filmed
now from a discussion.
Good evening, my name is Bernie Frazier, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident. There are a lot of people in Ferguson who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who have been fearful for 2 decades.
I think it must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017, those are the numbers you expect in a small war somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like you were saying, It's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, oppressive policing and marginalization, and it's it, it's, you know, it's that system that's carried on. And
it seems that
people are just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in